Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, March 9th, 2020, and I'm the host of the show, Cara Santa Maria. And I want to start, as I always do, by thanking those of you who have made Talk Nerdy possible this week. Remember, the show is and will always be 100% free to download, and that's because of the support from listeners just like you. The top supporters this week include Michael Gaucher, Mary Neva, Pasquale Gelati, Sinai, Ulrika Hagman, Dudas Infinitas, The Zombie Drummer, Brian Holden, Pedro M. Rosario Barbosa, Daniel Lang, David J. E. Smith. I was missing an and there, but that's everyone. Top supporters, though. There are so many other supporters in my list, and I just want to thank you all so much from the bottom of my heart. You guys are awesome, and you keep this show alive. All right, guys. So this week, I had the incredible opportunity to chat with a world-renowned mycologist. He's also the author of a brand new book, Fungipedia, A Brief Compendium of Mushroom Lore. So without any further ado, guys, here he is, Dr. Lawrence Millman, also known as Larry. Well, Larry, thank you so much for joining me today.
My pleasure. Delighted to be talking with you.
Yeah, so I'm really excited to talk about your newest book, and of course, this is the newest of several, called... Let's see if I can pronounce it right, because everybody loves to pronounce this word really differently. I'm going to say Fungipedia, A Brief Compendium of Mushroom Lore. Do you say Fungipedia or Fungipedia?
You hit the nail on the head. It's Fungipedia.
Yay! I had a professor once who said, it's fungi, not fun guy.
Right. You know that joke? People coming up to me saying, you must be a fun guy, and then bursting into laughter. It's happened about 9,800 times. And when they do that, I put on a fake accent and say, maybe a Russian accent, I do not know what you are talking about.
Yeah, right.
And you
pronounce the word then fungi?
I pronounce it fungi.
There
are very few fungi out at this time of year. That would be what I would say. But, you know, there is no real rule. If you looked it up somewhere online, perhaps it would say alternate pronunciations. Fungi is not as common.
Interesting. Okay, cool. That could be my Southern roots. I went to college in Texas, so
yes.
We pronounce everything strangely down there.
You do, but are you a Texan?
I am, born and raised in Texas, but I've lived in LA now for, I think, coming on 12 years.
I don't detect even a hint of a Texas accent in your voice.
That's what I'm often told, and strangely, I don't think I ever had one. So, but you should hear my parents and my sister speak. They have thick accents, apparently.
Was it Austin?
No, it was Dallas, actually, which has its own special accent.
Oh, yeah, I know. Austin people are often, you know, a little bit higher up on the proverbial podium, and they speak a little bit more haughtily because of the university. So I've mistaken Texas. People from Austin, I have not thought were from Texas, even though, because they're from Austin. So that's why I thought you might be from Austin.
And where were you... when you were a professor, where were you positioned?
University of Iceland, University of Minnesota, University of New Hampshire, Tufts University, and Harvard University.
Wow, you had five different faculty positions, and they really ran the gamut. Iceland.
Oh, I forgot. Goddard College.
Oh, so six. Okay. Iceland must have been an exciting experience. Are there a lot of mushrooms in Iceland?
Oh, absolutely. It's a very interesting place for mushrooms, and I've done actually quite a bit of mushroom work there. That was by far my most interesting teaching experience, mostly because the students there were incredibly eager to learn. Mm-hmm. At some of the other schools, maybe a little bit less so. They just wanted to get a degree and become an assistant in daddy's office.
Gotcha. Interesting. But here,
But in Iceland, it was different. And I actually had a love affair with Iceland. I really, at the time, I thought it was the sanest, healthiest place in the world. And I liked living there. And I think that aided and abetted my teaching abilities.
So where are you located now?
In Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Oh, nice. I really like Cambridge.
You've been there.
I have. It's a really good... It's a really good town. It's small, it's easy, but it's near enough to Boston, and then you're near enough to New York City. And I don't know, there's a very community kind of feel there.
Well, I feel exactly the opposite, that Boston and New York City are near to Cambridge, because I would much rather be here than in either of those two places.
That's fair.
You know, massive... urban, what we call them, urban nightmares.
Well, you know, I live now in LA, which is a pretty big urban center, but it is a little bit different because it's a much more, compared to a place like New York, for example, LA has a lot more green space and
yes.
It's much more almost like suburban in nature, even though it's an urban center. People live in houses, they have land, they have yards, and we have a lot of really beautiful parks.
Mm-hmm. And you're one of the Guinness record holders with respect to gridlock traffic.
That's true.
I mean, you're not at the very top. I was just in Puerto Rico, and that was pretty close. And I was actually doing mycological work there.
Very cool.
I like to go to places that are sort of terra incognitas with respect to the study of mushrooms, and a lot of tropical places and a lot of Arctic places are the temperate places, or I mean, even the Southwest, I would put that in the temperate world, more or less the temperate world. And where I live, more work has been done. But if one goes up to Greenland or down to Puerto Rico, very little work has been done. Indeed, I found a species on this recent trip, but probably is new to science.
Oh, very cool. And so when you say like work in mycology or work with mushrooms, you know, what does that really ultimately mean? You are a mycologist or somebody who has studied mushrooms throughout your career, and you know an awful lot about them.
Excuse me, not throughout my career. I evolved to study mushrooms, and I'll tell you how I evolved to study mushrooms. I spent a lot of time doing ethnographic work with native people in the North.
Okay.
I would collect stories, myths, taboos, lore, folk medicine. And every once in a while, a person, usually an older person, an elder, would tell me about the use of a certain fungus.
Okay.
I'm going to be using fungus and mushroom interchangeably.
Sure.
And I got interested in that. And because I had already been interested in the natural world, in insects and spiders and reptiles, my mother knew that I loved snakes, and she would, when she would go on canoeing trips and bring me back, if she saw a snake, bring it back as a present for me. Very nice of her. Not many mothers would do that. I would walk through the house with the snake wrapped around my neck, and no one seemed to mind. But at any rate, it was a short hop and jump from my collecting of ethnographic lore to seriously studying fungi. All that much on an academic level, because by that time, my imprisonments were few and far between.
And by imprisonment, you mean academic positions.
Yes. I am currently a research associate at Harvard, meaning that I can use the libraries, I can use the microscopes. And what I especially do is I donate specimens to Harvard that... are maybe unusual or rare. I dry them, put them in an envelope, and donate them.
Oh, very cool. You have that kind of symbiotic relationship.
Yeah, but you could do it too, Kara. I mean, if you found, for instance, a mushroom outside somewhere, if you managed to, if you're stuck in the midst of the gridlock in LA and you say, to hell with this, you climb out of your car, there's a bit of green space, and you find something very unusual looking, you study it, and maybe you don't identify, you give it to someone there who does. And I know someone in San Diego who can help you. And they said, oh, this is really unusual. You would dry it, put it in an envelope, and send it to the Farlow Herbarium at Harvard. And they would accept it, even though you're not a prisoner of war there.
Yeah. Well, that's very cool. I mean, citizen science is as
that's what it's called.
It.
Yes, citizen science. Exactly.
I love that.
Yeah. But my interest in mycology, as it's called, is not in academia today. There's a big focus on phylogenetics, DNAing things, finding out if this indeed is the same species everyone has always called it. And the any number of mycologists now in academia would have a hard time identifying a specimen that their teachers could identify in an instant because they are basically stuck within the, let's say, the hallowed halls of academia, and they don't go out into the field that much. I'm more of a field person. I want to see, I want the experience of looking at and studying what that mushroom is doing in the field. And then I will bring it back and study it microscopically. And then rare occasions, if I think it's most unusual or rare or something, I will give it to somebody to DNA. But I believe that, and I say this in the Fungipedia, by the way, in the, I think, I can't remember now which of the entries, could be phylogenetics. I say this has gone overboard, you know, and I mentioned that one of my gurus, Gary Linkhoff, you know who he was? He wrote the Audubon Guide to Mushrooms.
Oh, okay.
With respect to name change, he said, I feel like I'm suffering from early onset Alzheimer's. I have to come up, I have to remember a new name for a species each day because of those name changes.
Gotcha. Gotcha. So there are different approaches for sure.
There are very different approaches and you could probably have a talk nerdy interview with a phylogeneticist. A lot of us people in my, we refer to these people not as mycologists, but as molecular biologists.
And so
go ahead.
We refer to you, or you are often referred to as a mycologist. What did you actually study in school? And like when you were working as a professor and a researcher, what department were you in?
Wow. We only have an hour.
Because I mean, mycology is very specific, right? Like at a museum, there may be a whole mycology department, but usually at a university, you're going to be within a larger kind of ecology.
Yeah, you're right. And I regard the varied areas of my study as being very useful with respect to mycology because it gives me a broader contextual window than someone who started out very young and pursued simply systematics, i.e. identification. So I ended up getting a degree in English literature. Then I at the time I was thinking of getting a degree in comparative literature, meaning that I was interested in the literature of Europe. So I got a degree in English, and I have to say that most of the best scientific writers now have degrees in English. You've heard of David Quammen.
Of course, yeah.
And Carl Zimmer.
Oh, yeah. These are big science writers, for sure.
Yeah, both have degrees in English.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you do see this crossover with science journalism oftentimes where there's one camp that came up through sort of the natural sciences and then another camp that came up through either journalism or literature and then sort of learned the other tools kind of on the job, which is very cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, that's very true. And then we haven't finished. We've hardly started. I taught both creative writing, fiction writing, but I also taught natural history writing because I was by then a rabid naturalist. And so those were the things I taught. And then in Iceland, because I was an American, I taught American literature, but I also taught English, that is, how to write in English. And I would take students out, and we would have some experience. It would always be the outdoors. And actually, it was not always. There was one time when I took them to the waiting room at the local airport and told them to write up the experience because it was an interesting one. What was this class doing in the waiting room? All the waiting passengers thought as I was chatting. I wanted them to experience something different. And they did. And they wrote it up. And then I tried to make my literature, teaching of American literature, a bit different, too. I am a great admirer of Henry David Thoreau. Mm-hmm. And so I was teaching Walden. But I wanted to teach it in an appropriate place. And the place I chose was the large Reykjavik swimming pool, a body of water. It would be too cold in Iceland to go into a lake. My students would all suffer from hypothermia, and then I'd be blamed. But a heated swimming pool was not a problem. So we all were in one corner of the swimming pool holding our copies of Walden, and I was talking to them.
Wow. It's definitely a different experience, I think, than most students are offered, and a really different, we still haven't completely covered your path.
It's just beginning.
Yeah.
It's just beginning.
Earlier you mentioned ethnography, which I'm really excited to talk to you about. And it seems like that probably really not only has influenced your work throughout your career, but also has influenced your writing, especially with this new book that we're going to get into a little bit more, Fungipedia, how it's, it's kind of like an encyclopedia of fungi, fungi, as I call it. There is this real kind of mythology approach to it, right? Like you have science terms in here, of course, but then you have all of these stories about these different mushrooms, this different fungus, and exactly how we know what we know about it and what we think about it and what, kind of myths have been developed about it. And I can only imagine that you wear that lens a lot when you're doing your science.
Yes, I do. And there's actually a fairly neat segue. Because by the time I got my PhD, I was tired of academia, and I wanted to experience the opposite world. So I went to live in the west of Ireland, where people live not by the written word, but by the spoken word. And I hung out with traditional people, storytellers, they're called Shanachies, traditional craftspeople, small farmers. And I wrote my first book called Our Like Will Not Be There Again about this experience. And Our Like Will Not Be Again is sort of a translation of the last line of a book in Irish called An Tuilleanach, meaning the Islandman, written by a fellow in on a remote island in the west of the island, islands, the Great Blasket. He saw life changing all around him. And so the last sentence in the book is, I am writing down these words because our life will not be there again. And so that's what I felt in my wanderings, collecting lore that's going to disappear off the face of the earth, because of the rapid, vehement, not necessarily healthy changes going on our planet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so from Ireland, I ended up in Greenland. I collected some stories in Greenland. Actually, it was not quite like that. Ireland, Iceland. And periodically when I was in Iceland, I had a friend who was a pilot in Iceland who had a girlfriend in East Greenland. And that's a hour and a half, 2 hour flight.
Okay.
And I would hop a lift with him. And while he was visiting her, I'd wander about. And I got the idea. I mean, when I first started going there, I thought, oh, interesting, exotic, traditional place. But then I got the notion that the stories, as the Irish stories were absolutely fascinating and had to be documented. One thing that I noted was, to some extent, they had in the past been documented, but they were expurgated. Whereas when people told me stories, they didn't expurgate. Because the words that they used to describe various things were not considered bad or nasty or naughty, the way they might be in our own culture. So those words are in the stories. And for young kids, they could listen to some of these stories where, you know, for instance, there's one that I like. Oh, which one? We could go on many. I collected a whole book. It's called A Kayak Full of Ghosts, because I got a Guggenheim grant to travel around Arctic Canada to collect stories from Inuit people.
Oh, gosh.
And,
so there must be so many.
Stories in Greenland, too, from Greenlanders who aren't called, who do not call themselves Inuit.
Gotcha.
And so, you know, it would be no problem whatsoever for a Greenlander to tell a story where a woman has a sexual relationship with a bear.
Mm-hmm.
But you do that at Saturday morning Grange in someplace in America and say, she asked the bear, will you fuck me?
Yeah.
That would be a no-no. And the person the person who said it might well end up being, I wouldn't say put in prison, but reprimanded severely.
Sure. Yeah, it definitely would be more taboo.
Yeah. So as I said, when I was collecting stories and lore and taboos, every once in a while I would hear about a fungus. Like, for instance, a puffball. I don't think I need to explain to you what a puffball is.
Like an actual puffball or a puffball fungus?
Well, they're the same.
Okay.
A puffball is a type of fungus. Called a gastromycete. Gastro-stomach, it makes its spores on the inside, and then when you tap it, out come the spores.
Okay.
And the people, the Inuit in northern Canada, use this as a styptic, i.e., let's say you've cut yourself.
Mm-hmm.
What they will do is sprinkle the spores of a puffball into the wound, into the cut. And not only will it serve as a styptic, i.e. cause the blood to stop flowing, but it will also have antibiotic properties too. We all know that penicillium, which was turned into penicillin, is a world-renowned antibiotic. But they were there first. And then what they would do was they would put the puffball in the old days, they would tie it to wherever the wound was with a spider's web. More recently, they would use some string. But this works, by the way, if you harpooned yourself in the stomach and your intestines were coming out, what I've described to you won't work.
Yeah.
I'm talking about a cut.
Yeah.
That could have gotten infected, but probably wouldn't, given the antibiotic properties of the spores getting into your system.
Yeah. Wow. And so how...
And then I would, but every once in a while there'd be other stories, a lot pertaining to mushrooms. There's in the central Canadian Arctic, they don't eat mushrooms at all. because they believe that they are the Anak, the shit of shooting stars. And that's that's because the shooting stars, you can imagine, leaves a trail of detritus when it's traveling across the night sky.
Uh-huh.
And then suddenly there are mushrooms on the tundra in the next day or 2 days later. And this is usually in the fall, which, like here, where I am, is the best time for mushrooms. So they associate, those mushrooms with the shooting star. And as one, I think I mentioned this in Punjapedias, one Inuk said to me, I wouldn't want to call up one of my friends and say, hey, come on over for dinner. We're serving the shit of shooting stars.
Yeah, that doesn't sound appealing.
It doesn't
sound. I've personally always had an issue with eating mushrooms too.
Oh, you have?
I have that very earthy kind of like they grow on decaying things on the forest. Well, I know they don't all, but I don't know. I do have a bit of a hang up around eating them. I think they're beautiful and I think they're really interesting, but I've never really enjoyed consuming
them. Well, you suffer from what I would call modest mycophobia.
Okay. Oh,
not serious, but modest.
Yeah, I can be near them.
You can be near them, but you know, I would hear gagging sounds in this interview if you suffered from serious mycophobia. Mm-hmm. But yeah. I don't hear those gagging sounds.
No, and I understand why people enjoy them. And I actually don't so much mind their flavor. Like a lot of my friends and I will go out to eat hot pot, which is like a traditional Sichuan style where you have like this boiling broth with spicy peppers in it. And then you put in raw foods and you just pull the foods out as they cook. And so I'll usually go with a big group of friends and everybody loves mushrooms. And so they'll put mushrooms into the pot and it actually does really flavor the broth. Well, but the idea of like biting into one is not pleasing to me.
Well, the texture, some people do have problems with the texture as well. And some people adore the texture, like Asians, the texture is the most important thing at all. And this is why a number of species that we don't eat, they do eat.
Yeah, true.
I won't go into those, but what I want to say is that for me, yeah, I occasionally eat mushrooms. I see an edible that I particularly like, I might collect it. Or if I am distracted by another one that looks wild and unusual, I will ignore the edible one and collect the wild and unusual one, forgetting about the edible one. For me, edibility is the least interesting aspect of any fungus. What it's doing in the natural world, the way it looks, its color, you know, how it's procreating, all those are so much more interesting than, can I stuff it in my mouth?
Yeah. And will it make me sick?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, that kind of goes back to the question that I was hinting to earlier, which is, you know, what does studying fungus entail? What does it mean, really, to be a mycologist? And you talked about the kind of genetic approach to these things, but the more, I guess, I don't know what you would call it, ecological or just basic physiological, biological approach to studying them. Like what kinds of questions are you looking to answer?
Well, let me ask you a question. Are you a psychiatrist?
I am studying to become a psychologist, but my background is actually in neurobiology. So I was kind of a lab scientist first.
Okay. Well, I could ask, you know, what is a psychologist study? What is a neurobiologist study? The answers are myriad. It depends on where you want to go. Mm-hmm. And personally, I'm different from there are mycologists, as I've mentioned to you, who spend all their time surrounded by four walls and do sequencing of mushrooms. Mm-hmm. There are others who specialize, and I have a couple of friends do, on the relationships between insects and fungi, i.e. mostly it's to the disadvantage of the insect. I personally am a field-oriented individual. I'm at my happiest. I'm distracted from whatever woes I have in my real life, my unreal life indoors, when I'm outside looking for, well, not just mushrooms, but anything in the natural world. I think about it. I look around. I'm observant. And observe, to me, is the most important word in all of science. Observe. And I hate to throw in yet another rude remark about the phylogenetists, but they're not observing anything other than what appears on their cladograms, which are those, do you know what that is? It's sort of a graph that indicates the connections of one mushroom species to another.
Yeah, we see them a lot. They're kind of almost look like these long lines with little lines coming off of them.
Yes,
we see them
exactly.
A lot when we look at like dinosaur evolution, well, pretty much the evolution of anything.
That's right. Well, I actually wrote, I occasionally will write mushroom fiction. And I have a little book called Mushroom Apocalypse about mushroom picture. It's about a pair of well-to-do New Yorkers. There's a nuclear holocaust in New York. And, well, there's all the restaurants seem to be closed, indeed, destroyed. And where are they going to eat? They both like mushroom dishes. And there's a mushroom cloud in the sky. And the woman asked the man, do you think that's edible? I mentioned the cladogram, and I wrote a story about a mycologist who so devoted that he gets imprisoned inside one of them, and he's knocking at all the bars because there are bars. He can't get out. And a gentleman, actually the ghost of a gentleman named Linnaeus, appears. Mm-hmm. And our friend asks Linnaeus, well, I know you're a ghost, but can you help me get out of here? And the fellow, Linnaeus, says, you have to use one of your senses, S-E-N-S-E-S, and then disappear. Okay. Then disappears. The fellow says, I don't know what the bloody hell he was talking about. And then the next morning, he's running out of food, and he looks out the window, and there are a bunch of agarica species, mushroom, archetypal mushrooms, growing on the mulch outside his lab. And he says, how wonderful. And suddenly, the cladogram tends to disappear.
Hmm.
I think you followed that story.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there is this, I don't know what you would want to call it, this, do you think transcendence would be the right word to be using?
No, I don't. Not
you
at
don't.
All. This is, you know, whatever the opposite is, getting back to the real world.
Yeah.
The world of one's, what Dylan Thomas called one's five and country senses. Not one's five and country transcends this. but what I think is important is preserving, I mean, even more important. Okay, you study fungi and you learned about the environment, and your study of fungi inspires you to do whatever you can to preserve land.
Yeah.
And we're losing land at a reckless pace. And what I think mushroom clubs should do nowadays, instead of, they often have banquets, they focus a lot. I don't know about the, I have talked to your LA club. I thought they were okay. The focus tends to be on edibility and identification rather than this is a rare species. How can we preserve the land around it? Or how can we preserve the land where all these mushrooms are growing? That, I think, is crucial.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. And so, but you don't think that there's kind of a, I don't know, a spiritual component to that or a connectivity that people often feel when they do go outside.
Connectivity, yes, but not transcendence, because transcendence is to me more like mystical.
I agree with that.
I want the hardcore reality. There is that, and it's absolutely terrific.
Understood. Yeah, so kind of like being in this natural place and smelling and tasting and feeling and listening and just having your senses really kind of overwhelmed by this beauty and this this interesting. I mean, that's the thing too about mushrooms, right? They have this historical, at least I think in Western society, and I'm interested to see from you how that how that kind of comports with more Eastern or indigenous cultures, this kind of whimsical, almost, I'm thinking very like Lewis Carroll, this mm-hmm. kind of fantastical, I don't know, description to them. Like they're very childlike in a way. They're the stuff of nursery rhymes. They're the stuff of these fantasy stories. And they bring us a lot of joy. Like when we see mushrooms, we're like, that is otherworldly.
Mm-hmm. That's
true.
Why
do you think they do that for us?
Well, here's one possible explanation. And I might be exaggerating here, but we're related to mushrooms. We have mm-hmm. a common ancestor, 500 million year old one-celled sea creature called a coanoflagellate. Plants have a different ancestor. We look at a chrysanthemum and say, oh, isn't that cute? But I think our relationship, our connection with mushrooms goes deeper. And I would argue, only half seriously, that the reason it goes deeper is because we have an ancestral connection with them. And it has been presumed by certain people that one reason why we have a hard time fighting fungal infections is because fungi are us. I'm not certain that I would go that far, but who knows? Anyway, I think that's one of the reasons. I think another reason is that the astonishing variety that they proclaim to us when they appear, it means that we can't really immediately come to some conclusion as we would with a chrysanthemum. Oh, that's something we've cultivated. And isn't it cute? I mean, what is it? And we want to, some people on a certain level will ask, what is it doing? What's its relationship to the world around it? Well, what I'm actually trying to do is teach people to ask that question. It may be subliminal, but I'm trying to make it less subliminal when I, in this book, and also I lead numerous mushroom walks all year round, in the winter in New England.
And are there special, I mean, is the biodiversity similar in the winter, or is it just that you have to look a little bit harder and maybe you'll see things that you wouldn't see during the summer?
It's different because almost everything is on wood or under wood. The wood preserves moisture better than the ground, and there are a number of species that use the wood as a parka. So if they're under the wood, they're not freezing the way they would if they were on top of the wood or growing out of the ground. I recently, it's you know what the Christmas bird count is?
No, but I can imagine.
It's the Audubon Society. Mm-hmm. Has an annual Christmas bird count. They have it over a period of time, maybe 3 weeks in and around Christmas. Every year I have a Christmas mushroom count. There are any number of species. We get up to, this year we reached the top. It was 90 different species in one day.
Wow.
And all of them had some connection to wood. And again, it's because the wood is a substrate that they can manage and deals. They're cold adapted, some of them as well, so that they have a way of sequestering the moisture between their cells so they won't freeze if freezing conditions occur.
Sure.
There are some species that one finds in these parts only in the winter or the late fall or the early spring and not at other times of year. Not many, but some.
I mean, the diversity just from like a kind of morphological point of view is so vast. Like when we think of, you know, really biodiverse species like biodiverse, are mushrooms, is it an order? what would we call fungus?
It's an
order?
It's a kingdom. It's a kingdom.
Oh, it's a whole kingdom.
It's a kingdom. Plants are a kingdom. Animals are a kingdom. I don't know if there's still a protista, like a protozoa, algae or kingdom, et cetera. So they're a kingdom. But that kingdom broke off from plants only recently in the 1960s. Up to that point, fungi were considered lesser plants, even though they're more closely, far more closely connected to us than plants are.
Interesting. So do you think we just called them plants historically? Because, I mean, we didn't know. We just didn't know. You look
that's
at them
right.
and you go, plant-like, it's growing out of the ground or it's growing on something. How
that's
funny.
That's right. Just an odd plant. That's what they were considered. And they were diminished. So somebody at a university who studied fungi was considered studying a lower form of plant. I mean, they have different behavioral aspects that suggest something akin, I think, to intelligence. The way they get certain critters to come and taxi their spores, for instance. A lot of them have different chemicals that they release that suggest to perhaps a dipteran, a fly, oh, come here. I have something special for you. Maybe something akin to your, a sort of sexual pheromone or maybe just food. Hey, I smell like rotten carrion. Come and dine on me. They come and they find out they're mistaken, but they carry the spores off and taxi them to a different location.
Oh, very cool. And I know we often think of like molds, a lot of people will think of mold and they'll think of, ooh, that's that gross thing that grows on my walls if I have a moisture problem in my house.
Yeah.
But then we start thinking about things like slime molds and different sorts of species that we've encountered that do have this very complex, almost like animal-like intelligence.
Mm. But slime molds are not in the same kingdom as fungi.
They're not. Oh, how
interesting.
They're
not fungi at all.
So they shouldn't be called molds, dang it. This is very confusing.
That's why they're called, basically the word is myxomycete. And that probably isn't the best word either because people think mycota, mycete, mycologist. But they're more connected, they're more related to amoebas, most of them are.
Oh, that makes sense.
And they start out, in sort of tiny little cells moving along, and then they fuse together. And the reason people... up until, I don't know when, they were considered, maybe 100 years ago, they were considered fungi because in their final stage, the sporangial phase, they sporulated.
Gotcha.
And they kind of looked a bit like mushroom. I mean, not really, but they looked a bit like some.
Interesting.
But they're interesting. And by the way, just so you won't feel bad as a result of that mistake, most guidebooks put slime molds in. There's a whole special section in mushroom guidebooks for slime molds, but they don't put lichens in, and lichens are in the same kingdom as fungi.
Oh, that's so strange because, I could see why they would do it because people who are interested in going out and looking at molds might also be interested in finding slime molds, even though they're not, you said, kind of as genetically related. But I would think that if you were out looking at fungus, you would also be interested in looking at lichen.
You would think, but here's my explanation.
Mm-hmm.
I have a feeling it's pretty accurate. Let's say a publisher wants to sell a book. And so he puts in photos of the most charismatic things he can find, or she can find. And lichens, for the most part, aren't as charismatic as certain slime molds. They are odd-looking, some of them, yes, but they aren't quite as colorful.
Mm.
They observe certain colors. I mean, there's some that are bright. Is it Xanthorias you find? I think you might have them on rocks near the sea where you live. A yellow lichen. That lichen, by the way, needs a nitrogen fix. And can you guess what it gets that fix from?
The soil? No, probably not, because they're on trees a lot of the time. Where does it get it?
Well, bird shit.
That makes sense.
A bird comes, shits on the rock, and then the lichen grows all starting on the top of the rock.
Yep.
That this makes is, sense. You know, it's called sunburst lichen, Xanthoria species. But apart from that, lichens are gray and silver, light green. And to a publisher, this isn't charismatic at all. Putting pictures of lichens in a mushroom book would discourage sales. So they thought. But putting pictures of slime molds, I don't want to mention which book, but this happened with one of my books. I wanted to put in lichens, not slime molds, and the publisher vetoed the idea.
Oh, how funny. Oh, my gosh. What about yeast? Yeast is a fungus, right?
Yes, it is.
And so that seems like it has its whole own kind of characteristics. Like, it seems very different than what we think of when we think of, like, mushrooms.
And you are absolutely right. Yeasts are probably the only fungal entities that don't depend on what's called a mycelium. A mycelium, for those listeners who don't know what that is, it's sort of the hidden root-like portion that creates the mushroom, either inside a log or underground, or even in one's house. Sometimes you more likely see it in one's house as you see these separating stringlets going off on the bathroom wall. Sometimes those separating stringlets will indeed emulate the head of Jesus. And Jesus has appeared quite a bit in bathrooms, you know, because bathrooms are a perfect place for moisture. Fungi depend on moisture. And these indoor molds, we call them, love, what better place? I mean, a dried up library is not as good as a bathroom.
So you're saying it's not because cleanliness is next to godliness. There's no association there.
This could be a good joke. I mean, if one can think about it, cleanliness, actually, that even by itself works well. If one wanted to do it, you can. It's probably all over the internet. There are accounts of somebody in some rural area finding what appears to be the outline of Jesus on their bathroom wall.
Yep.
And it's really a mold.
That's so funny. So
I believe your word for it, your phrase for it, works perfectly.
Oh my gosh, that's hilarious. And so, I mean, I have to know, as somebody who's like traveled the world, who has written about these things, who has collected multiple specimens, studied them, you know, understands not just the physiology or the ecology or, you know, the basic biology, but also the humanity, the connectivity of mushrooms with various peoples. Do you have a certain type of fungus that you are particularly drawn to? It's so hard to say, like, what's your favorite child? But is there a grouping or...
one I'm looking at this very moment. This very moment being whatever the moment is in the field. But, but, you know, I could say what I prefer. I prefer what's called polypores. These are usually pretty robust wood-inhabiting species. Some of them are perennial. Mm-hmm. And some of them, there's one, the artist conch, Ganoderma aplanatum, that has been, they examined and a specimen was found to be 73 years old.
Oh, wow.
A lot of them can live as long as they're getting nutrients from the wood.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really like them. They're sort of the wise elders of kingdom fungi. And I also like their robustness. Like if you find some little pretty delicate yellow and pink mushrooms. By the time that you get home, they might be dried up. But if you collect polypores, I have one on my table right now. I have an entry on it, Haploporus. It's a Haploporus species, and it has an anise-like smell. And the native people in the north would use it as to repel evil spirits. And I have it on my desk for the same purpose, to repel evil spirits. And I have to say that it's been very seldom that an evil spirit has shown up here.
Oh my gosh, I love that. You mentioned like the hardiness of these. How do mushrooms usually die? Is it that they've been on something that has decayed to the point where there's no nutrition left and they just kind of dry up? Or, I mean, what does the life cycle look like of a traditional mushroom?
The problem with that question, Kara, is that there's, you know, there's so many different types of mushrooms and they all die differently. I mean, you could, how do mammals die? Could you answer that question?
I guess their organs break down, but they also die from disease and from injury and from, that's true.
And there's from so pollution. And how do people die from disease and viruses and old age? And with respect to the polypores, let's say, but it often with the polypores and other wood inhabiting fungi, it's when there are no longer any nutrients left in the wood. But they will have sporulated, releasing billions of spores, so that the next generation, and you could even argue that they are prolonging their own lives by reducing their spore, releasing their spores somewhere else. So you can say, you know, maybe that's not an offspring of that fungus I saw 10 years ago. It's simply the same one in a slightly younger guise. Because it comes from its spores. But of course, one could say that about a human child, the, you know, great, 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 great grandson of George Washington. You know, that's not a young kid today. That's George Washington in camouflage.
Yeah, just shuffled up a bit with some other people.
I should mention something I'm sort of working on. There is a lichen, an Umbilicaria lichen. This is called rock tripe, tryptorosis, that grows on rocks and boulders. And my guess is you don't have it in Southern California, especially on glacial erratics. Okay. And, you know, it is, if you boil it, it is an edible. Native people had it as an edible when everything else ran out. It doesn't have a whole lot of flavor. It has texture, which is why in Japan it is well-liked, but not a lot of flavor. But it is thought that George Washington and his men survived Valley Forge, the cold, cold winter, and that's not a problem for any lichen, much less this one, Umbilicaria species. It survived Valley Forge by eating this lichen. Now, if that's the case, we owe our freedom from British tyranny to a lichen.
Wow. Yeah. Not charismatic, my ass.
Yeah, that's right. That's a good, very good. Well put, by the way. Very felicitous.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. Oh my gosh, I love that. That's amazing.
Yeah, perpetuated. It's, you know, look up Umbilicaria species, tryptorosis. It also did, it's not putative. It did, Sir John Franklin, you know who he was? The Arctic explorer. They ran out of food on one of their expeditions and they survived by eating tryptorosis. You know, that's well documented. If you look at his journals, that's from 1820. If you look at his journals toward the end, when they were, after they ran out of food and they'd eaten their boots, natives told them about this. And every page has a variation of spent the day looking for tryptorosis.
Wow. It's fascinating how you've written several books up to this point. Obviously, your publisher reached out and sent me a copy of Fungipedia, and that was kind of the impetus for us to get together to have this conversation. And this is also your most recently published book.
Yes.
It's interesting how all of these stories, not all of them, but of course, a lot of these stories really do come together in this almost like pocket compendium. It really is an encyclopedia. And it's not like, oh, this species, that species, this species, that species. It's also got people. It's also got stories. It's also got, parts of, the things that make them up, the way that we use them. How on earth did you decide, A, what to include in this? Because it probably could have been thousands of pages long, or it could have been this very, concise compendium that you put together. And B, how did you decide, I guess this is a separate conversation, to make the book so whimsical in its appearance? You know, it's cloth covered, it's got these fabulous drawings by Amy Jean Porter, these beautiful, kind of natural history drawings. There's so much that went into something that's so deceptively kind of small and simple. I'd love to hear your process about that.
Well, I wrote the book, and then Princeton decided on hiring Amy Jean to make these whimsical drawings. They also did the cover, and they also did the design. So that part of it was not up to me at all. They were maybe expanding on my text, you could say. Mm-hmm. But in terms of the book, I don't know. I've written 18 books.
Oh, my gosh. 18? Yeah. How many of them have been, academic books versus, I guess, what you would call like popular kind of trade books?
Well, I'd say not a single one of them has been an academic book, unless you want to call this an academic book. It was published by an academic press, but it's for the so-called citizen scientist.
Yeah, and you see this on, I've seen this like highlighted on, like when you walk into stores in Joshua Tree, when you walk into very kind of like modern, kind of cool, kitschy, houseware stores and things like that. This book I've seen in a lot of places. Because
you have? Oh, well.
Oh, yeah.
I appreciate your telling me that.
Absolutely. Because it's beautiful to look at, but it's also really interesting and it's digestible. You know what I mean? It's not overwhelming from a scientific perspective.
Yes.
It is whimsical. It's fun.
Well, that's lovely. I actually walked into one of the few bookstores in Labrador in early November. And what should I see but this book staring at me?
That must be such a fun experience.
It was a fun experience. And then I delight in getting emails from friends who are spread out across North America saying, I picked it up in my local bookstore.
Yeah.
So it has been distributed very well. And I would say that rather than ask me what books are academic, what books of mine have been well distributed, I'd say very few, apart from this one.
Well, and one of the things that, it kind of came out secondarily when we were conversing prior to connecting about your affiliative relationship with computers and technology,
yeah.
is that you've had some previous books that are, I guess, less about something, like a specific type of mushroom or a specific type of this or that, but more about, human beings' relationship with nature, that you've really, this theme that's been very important to you, which is reconnecting with the natural world, spending time outside, and seeing the real, I guess, threat that our behavior and our decision-making has.
Well, this started with my first book that I mentioned to you,
wow.
Our Like Will Not Be There Again. I was on a small island in the west of Ireland. Everyone communicated. And then suddenly, the first television arrived in a bar, and people stopped talking. And the people who didn't care for it referred to it as the monster.
Wow.
And essentially, the book, one of the themes of that book is how television has replace storytelling in the West of Ireland. And I pursue this theme right up to two books ago. It's called At the End of the World, published by St. Martin's, 2017. And what it does, and there's a bit of stuff about mushrooms there. I refer to a particular unusual species and say, I would rather find it than find a bag of gold. But what it does is it documents a series of murders in the Arctic among very traditional people who were just introduced to Christianity. And I had a hard time turning this into a book until I decided that I couldn't write about the past. This was in 1941, without writing about the present. And I wrote about the present religion, which was screens, be they computer screens, iPhone screens, or television screens. And in a very, essentially, I saw that as an equally destructive religion to the one that affected this group of animists in the Canadian Arctic.
Wow.
And I document instances where, for instance, in Boston one day, I was walking along and I saw a woman with her cell phone swaggering the way they do, zombie-like, back and forth. And I said, if she's going left, I'll go right. If she's going right, I'll go left. And I made a mistake and she smashed into me. And she said, oh, I'm so sorry. I was just trying to find out the weather.
And oh, no.
I pointed skyward, smiled, and limped on.
Oh, no. Yeah, that's just some brutal irony for you.
There right is. There. And then I saw somewhere, this was in Vermont, I was going through the woods and there was a little kid, maybe four years old, following the mother through the woods. I don't know where they were going. I was looking for mushrooms. And the little kid was saying over and over again, password, 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 mm-hmm. password. Yeah. Obviously having learned it from a parent.
Yeah, you do see it. You know, there's all of the examples of kids swiping books to try and turn the page.
Oh, yeah.
Because that's
yeah.
what they're used to on their iPads. And yeah, I mean, it is, you know, obviously we could spend a whole other hour talking about the good that comes from connectivity across the world and also a lot of the kind of evils of this. But obviously, none of that undermines the argument that that we're missing something when we just don't go outside. And it's not just that we're missing something. Oh, yeah, we're missing something. Like, it is our evolutionary past. Like, it is really who mm-hmm. we are to be in nature. And the fact that we are completely and utterly, you know, destroying, altering, it's such a big conversation to be had, right? Like, this conversation about the way that we have altered our natural world we've bent it to suit our kind of selfish needs, the way that we have separated ourselves from the natural world. You know, there's that classic cartoon, I don't know if you've seen it, called The Fence, where it shows several different window panes, you know, several different cells of the cartoon. And in the first one, it shows like a globe and the globe is completely covered with like lush green nature. And then there's a tiny little fence surrounding something. And it says, you know, we call it the fence and we keep it there. I don't remember. I'm paraphrasing for sure, to keep the predators out or to keep, you know, to keep ourselves safe. And then mm-hmm. eventually at the very end, it's like we call it the fence. And it's the whole world is barren and the fence is actually surrounding the natural components. And that's really what we see now. Natural parks, national parks, wildlife preserves, things like that. Like what we think of as quote unquote wild is now in many ways protected. It itself is fenced off from what we think of as civilized or, you know, developed across the globe. It's the antithesis. It's the opposite of what these kinds of barriers originally, I guess, were developed to serve. And it's,
I know, that's why I don't
existentially
like
existentially violent.
That's why I don't like urban parks unless I'm looking for mushrooms in them, because all around are signs of urban development. I should mention that in this book, At the End of the World, the one about the two destructive religions, I mm-hmm. was in the islands where the murders occurred 60 years later, of course, during 9/11. And there was one TV, and I was there with a bunch of Inuit watching outtakes from 9/11. And yeah. I'll never forget what one elderly man said, looking at New York's remaining skyline. He said, "How can people live so far above the ground?"
Yeah, and it's, we don't even think about it. It's just so normal to us now.
It's so normal. We don't think about it.
Wow. That kind of profound statement, that kind of, you know, rhetorical question, really. it's a good transition point for me, because, you know, I don't want to take up too much of your time today, to kind of flip over to what we generally do at the end of the show, where I ask my two closing questions. But maybe before we do that, I just want to ask you first, is there anything that you think we haven't covered, anything that, you know, we wish we would have talked about up to this point that we haven't gotten to?
Yes, and we would need to have, let's see, somewhere between 60 and 70 more interviews to cover those subjects.
Well, perfect.
Because, you know, the way I do this is I move in and out of the fungal world. I mean, talking about fungi, you know, what John Muir said is, when you look at nature, you find that everything is hitched to everything else. So somehow we are talking about mushrooms, and I'm ending up mentioning a remark made by an Inuit elder. How can people live so far above the ground?
Yeah.
There are quite a few other things. What I could probably say, first thing that comes to mind is to tell listeners, get outside, leave your abode, turn your computer off, leave your cell phone indoors, go out and look for fungi and admire them, stare at them in wonder, and don't collect them. Because one of the issues that the book mentions is over-collecting. Yeah. You know, there's a huge industry in the Pacific Northwest where certain edibles are collected. And over time, this is going to reduce the genetic identities of species, make them susceptible the way that certain people in small towns in Maine are to inbreeding in a way that doesn't help with intelligence. And the result then is also going to be fewer fungi. Fewer fungi will mean a less healthy world. So that's why I'm saying, in this sort of roundabout way, stare and admire and don't pick.
Yeah, I mean, that's obviously incredible advice. Not just that, but the advice about going outside and just existing in nature and really observing. And I have a feeling that that advice is also going to be tied to your answers to my two final questions. I could be wrong, but if you're ready for them, they're sort of like
ready.
Big picture questions. Okay. So I want you to think about the future in whatever context is really relevant to you, you know, right now in your life, in your work, and beyond. So number one, I want you to tell me, what is the thing that really does keep you up the most at night? The thing that you are deeply, maybe even like existentially concerned about. But then on the flip side of that, so that maybe we end on a little bit of a high note, what is the thing that you are genuinely and like truly authentically optimistic about? What are you looking forward to?
Well, the answer to the first question, what keeps me up at night, is contemplating climate change and the not only imminent disasters. I've spent a lot of time in the Arctic, the ongoing disasters, Northwest Passage used to be blocked with ice. And in 2015, a 13-deck cruise ship called the Crystal Serenity sailed through the Northwest Passage from Seattle to New York without a single problem. To me, that's terrifying.
Yeah.
In answer to questions about this word optimism, I'm not certain what it means. I am not a very optimistic person. My ex told me once that I was a glass half empty sort of person. I said, no, that's not true. I'm a glass two-thirds empty sort of person. optimism comes when I connect with some of my friends and we have similar beliefs. I am not optimistic about the future of our planet. Yeah. And when I think optimistically, I have to think in terms of something else on a much smaller scale, like, oh, I'm looking forward to getting out in the woods today. Something maybe a bit more egocentric, because personally, and you could use this or not, I think it's hopeless. I think we've all already passed the mark with respect to, let's say, carbon emissions, but also lots of other things that will allow us to go back. Overpopulation, yeah. Major issue. Can we underpopulate now that we've overpopulated? Can we go from 7.5 billion down to 1 million? No. So I really don't have much hope.
I mean, I think that that's fair. And in a big way, I think it's really refreshing to hear somebody speak in that way, because I think that we have a tendency, especially in kind of Western society, to like put a silver lining on everything, to wrap everything up in a shiny bow and say, even though X, Y, and Z, look at the bright side, look at how, you know, look at what is good that about this. And the truth of the matter is, I think we are optimisticalizing ourselves into oblivion. We are so good at saying, yeah, but we'll figure it out. Yeah, but it's not as bad as it seems. Yeah, but let's take the positive with the negative, that we basically are undermining the reality of the situation. So I think it's really refreshing to hear that kind of perspective, because we don't hear it often enough.
Well, and also when one thinks in these terms, there's not a whole lot of room for disappointment. You're not going to fall very far if you fall. Whereas if someone is an optimist and hears the seas have risen sufficiently high that in 5 years, both New York City and Los Angeles will become aquatic, that person will, he will crash or she will crash to the ground. Whereas if I hear something like this, I will say, well, I expected that.
Absolutely. I mean, there really is a difference, I think, between being a pessimist or being a cynic and having a realistic outlook. And the problem is that the reality of what is happening right now is almost indistinguishable from cynicism, because it really truly is that.
I agree. Yeah. Totally agree. Yeah. I totally agree. Cynicism or pessimism. I mean, there's a certain... To acknowledge that it's hopeless frees you to, at least in your own life, to pursue what's important to you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that, to me, is it's one of the reasons why, rather than run for Congress, much less president, why I haven't become a city councilor with the hope that, oh, well, let's create some more green space in Cambridge. Look, there's a vacant lot. Let's turn it into green space. Why I haven't diminished myself by doing something like that.
But instead, spend your time, you know, really being able to kind of squeeze what joy, what kind of existential, I guess, meaning you can out of existing in what nature we have left.
I agree. And making in the process a few converts from by individuals who have read my writing.
Absolutely. Well, I guess now would be the time to remind people that the book is Fungipedia, a brief compendium of mushroom Lore by Lawrence Millman. Larry, thank you so much for spending the time that you spent with me today and for trusting in the process. I know that there was a lot of technical requirements to be able to do it. And so I'm really glad that we were able to.
I am too. And I'm delighted to have this conversation, more like a conversation than an interview with you.
Yes. Thank you so, so much. And everybody listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.